Need a gift that won't be regifted? Create a Buzz Book, the new softcover photo book by Nations Photo Lab. Relive the memories you don't want to forget. Your child's first year, your wild bachelorette, or your trip to Spain. All you have to do is fill the pages with your favorite photos. It's that easy to make something truly memorable. Make every moment matter. Head on over to nationsphotolab.com/buzzbooks and use code JUNKIE for your free Buzz Book. It's October 8th, 2018, and I'm on the phone with Alan Bloom, a renowned criminal defense attorney from San Diego, California. We're talking about one of his clients, Cynthia Summer, who was charged with murdering her husband back in 2007. And it seems hard for Alan to hide his irritation during our conversation, even now, as he talks about how Cynthia was treated by the San Diego District Attorney's Office. Cynthia's case gained national attention back then, and her trial was live-streamed on Court TV. But it wasn't necessarily the facts of the case that had the nation's attention. It was the salacious details the prosecution presented about how Cynthia acted in the days, weeks, and months after her husband's death.
Because of her post-death behavior, she reacted to his death in a way that others wouldn't have reacted or didn't think that she should have reacted. She had sex with a friend of his. She had she went down to Tijuana and partied, and she had a breast implant. And because the district attorney made such a point of that, as opposed to real facts of the case, it got a lot of publicity.
This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 61. It all started at 1:34 a.m. on February 18th, 2002, when Cynthia Summer dialed 911 to report that her husband, Todd Summer, had collapsed. According to Cynthia, he had gotten up out of bed just minutes before, turned on the light, and told her that he didn't feel good, before then collapsing onto the floor. Todd was just 23 years old and was a Marine sergeant in the military. He and Cynthia had met in 1999, just 3 years prior, when he was 19 and Cynthia was 25. They had married, had a baby, and now lived at the Marine Corps Air Station Miramar in San Diego, California, with Cynthia's three children from a previous marriage. Cynthia could be heard on the 911 call, telling Todd, "Todd, I love you. Please don't do this to me. What am I going to do without you?" The dispatcher asked if Todd was conscious and breathing, and Cynthia said no. Cynthia asked if she should start doing CPR, and the dispatcher told her yes. Cynthia begged them to hurry and to send someone to their home. Earlier that day, Cynthia, Todd, and their four kids had gone to an amusement park, and they had just put the kids to bed when Todd told her that his heart felt like it had been fluttering. Cynthia had asked them if they should go to the hospital, and Todd told her no, that he was just going to sleep it off. Military emergency technicians responded to the scene, but it was too late. Todd's skin was blue and mottled. He was taken to the hospital, and a half hour later, was pronounced dead. An autopsy showed that Todd's death had been caused by cardiac arrhythmia. The Naval Criminal Investigative Service, or NCIS, conducted a routine investigation into the circumstances surrounding his death, but concluded that he had died of natural causes. As time went on, Cynthia started dating someone else, and she and her children moved to Florida with her new boyfriend. But also as time went on, investigators with the NCIS started to become suspicious that there was something off with Todd's death. According to Todd's medical records, he had been feeling ill and had even gone to see a doctor twice in the days before his death. The first time he went, the doctor told him it might be food poisoning, but when that didn't subside, Todd went back a few days later and was given an IV fluid and a prescription for the stomach flu. And in addition to Todd's medical records, the investigators also thought there was something odd about Cynthia's behavior after her husband's death. Neighbors had reported that she was throwing loud parties. She had gone to Tijuana with some friends on a party trip. And just 2 months after Todd's death, she had spent over $5,000 on breast implants. Investigators ordered that Todd's tissue samples be sent to the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, or AFIP, in Washington, D.C. for testing. They were looking for heavy metals that would show if Todd had been poisoned. And sure enough, when the test results came back, the tissues from Todd's liver and kidneys tested positive for 1,000 times the normal level of arsenic. On November 30th, 2005, about 3.5 years after Todd died, Cynthia was arrested in Palm Beach County, Florida, and charged with murder. Deputy District Attorney Laura Gunn told reporters that this was the coldest homicide she would ever try, in terms of being absolutely cold-blooded. They were alleging that Cynthia had murdered Todd in order to collect his insurance money. Prosecutors then filed for special circumstances of murder by poison and murder for financial gain. They decided not to go for the death penalty, so instead, she was facing life in prison without the possibility of parole. Cynthia was extradited from Florida to California and was held without bond while she awaited her trial. And while she waited, court documents filed by prosecutors were released, accusing Cynthia of having been eager to collect Todd's life insurance, which was $250,000, as well as monthly survivor payments. Media outlets ran stories with headlines such as "Woman Accused of Killing Husband for Implants" and "Arsenic and Black Lace. DA says she killed hubby to pay for boob job." Cynthia's attorney went on the defensive, telling reporters that Cynthia was only trying to make herself feel better after the death of her husband. But as much as prosecutors wanted to use Cynthia's behavior after her husband died against her, the judge in the case, Judge Peter Detta, ruled that testimony about Cynthia's lifestyle afterwards wouldn't be admissible in court. He said it had little to do with whether Cynthia poisoned Todd or not. Cynthia's trial began in January 2007. Deputy District Attorney Laura Gunn told the jury that Cynthia was the only person greedy enough to murder her husband for his military benefits, and that she was the only person close enough to him to poison him. In the week leading up to his death, she said the only people around him were Cynthia and the four kids. She called arsenic the perfect poison and pointed out that it's odorless, colorless, and tasteless, and that it's accessible to the general public. She said Cynthia earned minimum wage at a Subway sandwich shop, and that after her husband died, she received $6,000 in a death gratuity payment from the military, and then $250,000 a month later from his life insurance policy. And Cynthia wasted no time in spending that money, Gunn said, on shopping, parties, and of course, breast implants. She said Cynthia wasn't living within her family's means and hadn't been. A year prior to Todd's murder, the military had turned her down for a loan due to that very reason. And Gunn said a trust fund in Todd's name had been drained down to zero on January 31st, just 8 days before Todd got sick. Prosecutor Gunn told the jury that Cynthia had gone to see a plastic surgeon on February 8, 2002, for a consultation on breast implant surgery. She only had $280 in her bank account at the time. Gunn said Cynthia told investigators when they interviewed her that Todd had gone with her to that appointment, but Gunn said she had lied about that. In the week and a half before Todd died, he suffered from acute gastrointestinal distress, vomiting, nausea, and diarrhea, all symptoms consistent with acute arsenic poisoning, she said. She also pointed out that 2 months after Todd died, Cynthia started a relationship with a new boyfriend. In his opening statements, Cynthia's trial attorney, Robert Udell, told the jury that Cynthia didn't do it. He said there would be no evidence presented that would show that Cynthia had any connection to arsenic. There's not one document, not one piece of physical evidence to connect Cindy to arsenic, or even an attempt to get arsenic. Nothing, he said. He said that evidence will also show that Cynthia did not benefit financially from Todd's death, and that the evidence will show that he was the best thing that had ever happened to her. After Todd died, he said Cynthia lost her medical benefits, Todd's monthly income, and their free housing from when they lived on the base, and that her life came crashing down. If the motive for killing Todd was money, this cost her significantly, he said. He called Todd Cynthia's knight in shining armor, saying that after a failed marriage and three kids, Cynthia and Todd had married after dating for 6 months. Todd was helping her raise her kids, and she was deeply in love with him. Udell told the jury that Todd may have been exposed to arsenic during a military trip he went on to El Centro, California, on February 8th. He said a former toxic waste dump was located there, and he noted that Todd first noticed that he was getting sick after eating some egg rolls he had purchased from a gas station market on his way home. The prosecution appeared to have two strategies when it came to presenting their evidence, both going towards an alleged motive. The first was to show that Cynthia and Todd were having major financial difficulties at the time of Todd's death, and the second was to show Cynthia's unusual behavior after his death. The first responder to the scene was one of the first witnesses for the prosecution. He said when he arrived, Todd's body was cool to the touch and that Cynthia was standing over him. He told the court that Cynthia made a comment about Todd's life insurance policy as Todd was lying on the floor, unresponsive. Cynthia told him that they had joked about it a lot, but that she never thought she'd see it. It referring to the insurance money. The office manager for Dr. Scott Miller testified that on February 8th, Cynthia came in for a breast augmentation consultation. She had a before photo taken and was told the surgery would cost her $5,400. She came in again a little over 2 months later, after Todd had died, on April 18th to have the surgery done. She paid by personal check before that, on April 4th. On cross-examination, the office manager said that Cynthia had listed Todd as her emergency contact and that she was given information about financing plans to pay for it. Cynthia's in-laws, Todd's parents, testified too, about their son's relationship with Cynthia and about their financial struggles. Todd's mom, Yvonne, told the jury that when her 20-year-old son married Cynthia, she was concerned about the rush. But she grew to love Cynthia, and they had a very good relationship. She said Todd and Cynthia seemed to be very happy together, but that occasionally, Todd would talk about money problems and not having enough food for the kids. She recalled getting a phone call from Cynthia about a week before Todd died. Cynthia told her that Todd was vomiting and had diarrhea and asked her for advice on what she should do. Yvonne thought the call was strange, and so did her friends when she told them about it. After Todd's death, she and her husband flew to Miramar from their home in Florida to be with Cynthia. A couple nights after Todd died, Cynthia told them she wanted to go out with some friends, and so Yvonne told her that she would watch Cynthia and Todd's son. She called Cynthia's phone after midnight when Cynthia still wasn't home. And when Cynthia did get home, she was mad that Yvonne had called. She said Cynthia told her to mind her own business and that she would grieve her way and Yvonne could grieve hers. Yvonne's husband, Mitchell, Todd's father, also told the jury about Todd and Cynthia's money problems. He said he loaned them about $9,000, made a down payment on their minivan, and co-signed on their car loan to help them out. At Todd's burial in Nashville, he said Cynthia brought a few of her military friends with her and stayed at a motel nearby. He went to go pick her up, and he said the room looked more like a party thing and that there were beer and wine glasses everywhere. He said after Cynthia received the insurance money, he told her that she should put $40,000 away for each of her children and for herself, and $80,000 for her and Todd's young son. But he said Cynthia didn't want to put that much away. He finally convinced her to put $25,000 in a trust fund for her kids, $40,000 for her and Todd's son, and $25,000 for herself. The prosecution also called Cynthia's first husband's mother to the stand. She told the court that when Cynthia told her about Todd, she described him as gorgeous, a Marine, with wealthy parents and a big trust fund. She said he seemed to be pretty well off for a young man. And Richard Overfields, an accountant who knew Cynthia and Todd, said that he offered his condolences to Cynthia within hours of Todd having passed away. He said she thanked him and then told him that she had questions about their taxes. She asked, "What do we do since Todd is dead as far as getting his signature and filing the return?" Eva Stoner, a military police officer who drove Cynthia to the hospital that night, testified that Cynthia asked her to stop so that she could get a pack of cigarettes on their way there. When asked if there was any sense of urgency to get to the hospital, Eva said not from Cynthia. On cross-examination, however, Eva said that Cynthia told her that her husband was a good man and she was sure he would be okay. And when she was informed that her husband was dead, Cynthia cried and asked Eva to go with her to see his body. A Miramar station supervisor testified about an unusual question Cynthia had asked him while at the hospital. He said he asked her if she needed anything, and in turn, she asked him if she would have to repay Todd's enlistment bonus. He told the court that it wasn't the type of thing he would expect from someone who had just lost her husband. The prosecution also called a forensic accountant to the stand, April Real, who testified that she had analyzed Todd and Cynthia's finances. She told the court that in the short term, Cynthia did benefit financially from Todd's death. Before Todd died, his monthly income was about $1,700 a month. They didn't have to pay for housing or medical care, since those were provided on base. After Todd's death, Cynthia had to leave the base, but she received monthly checks from Social Security and VA benefits, up to $7,900 a month, she said, and then received the payout from Todd's insurance. Real told the court that Cynthia had spent the insurance money before the end of the year. She said 49% of it went into trusts for her kids, 24% went directly to Cynthia, and $25,000 was put into a trust in her name that was controlled by Todd's family. The rest, Real said, Cynthia used to pay off loans, buy a computer, pay the IRS, and to other expenses. On cross-examination, she agreed that Cynthia did not purchase any luxury items with the money. Dr. Stephen Robinson, the medical examiner who conducted Todd's autopsy, testified that Todd's original cause of death was ruled a heart failure because nothing else seemed to make sense and there was no reason to suspect foul play. He said their findings were basically none. Todd was 23 years old, 6'1" tall, 204 pounds, and had a heart that was anatomically normal. There were also no drugs found in his system. The prosecution then tried to somehow tie Cynthia to arsenic. They called three different agents with the NCIS to the stand, all who testified about how easy it was for someone in the general public to purchase a poison like arsenic. One agent purchased 7 vials of it on eBay for $25. And Ricky Rendon, another special agent with the NCIS, testified about other ways they looked into connecting Cynthia with the arsenic. He told the court that he traveled to London to question Cynthia's ex-husband. He asked him whether Cynthia had ever watched CSI or Forensic Files, to which her ex-husband said no. He told Rendon that she watched Party of Five, Beverly Hills 90210, Melrose Place, and Friends. Rendon testified that he contacted the producers of Melrose Place and found out that there had been 6 episodes that revolved around poison. But he had no evidence that Cynthia had ever seen those episodes or had mimicked them. Rendon also testified that he purchased something called Grants Kills Ants, an ant poison laced with arsenic. He purchased it at a local grocery store where Cynthia likely shopped. However, he didn't have any proof that she had purchased any herself. And next up, we'll see what the defense has to say, right after this quick break from today's sponsors. Simple Contacts lets you conveniently renew your contact lens prescription and reorder your contacts from anywhere in minutes. It's vision care for the 21st century. The Simple Contacts vision test is self-guided and takes less than 5 minutes. It's not a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but it will save you so much time when you need to renew and reorder. It's designed by ophthalmologists and a licensed doctor that reviews every test, so you skip the office visit, but not the care. Simple Contacts has all the brands and types of lenses you're familiar with, so you never have to shop around to find your lenses at the best price. And best of all, Simple Contacts saves you money. The vision test is only $20. Their contact lens prices are unbeatable, and standard shipping is free. I still remember when I wasn't using Simple Contacts to reorder my contact lenses. What a pain in the butt it was to have to go to the eye doctor and wait in the waiting room for what seemed like forever. But now I use Simple Contacts whenever it's time for me to reorder. And each time, I'm always amazed at how easy and fast it is to just open the app, take the quick vision test, choose my brand of contacts, and then boom, I'm done. In way less time and spending less money. Get $20 off your contacts at simplecontacts.com/junkie20 or enter code junkie20 at checkout. That's simplecontacts.com/junkie20 or enter code junkie20 at checkout to get $20 off your contacts. Do you have trouble sleeping? I know oftentimes I do. But last night, I listened to one of my absolute favorite childhood stories, The Velveteen Rabbit, read out loud in a calm, soothing voice right from my phone as I was falling asleep. And it worked. Within minutes, I was off to dreamland. And that's why I'm excited to partner with Calm, the number one app for sleep, meditation, and relaxation. Calm gives you the tools you need to live a happier, healthier, and more mindful life. Like sleep stories, soothing tales read by well-known voices to help you unwind and fall into a deep sleep each evening. It's like bedtime stories for grown-ups, but they also have sleep stories for kids too, which is what I actually listened to. They also have sleep meditations, from a series of 10-minute sessions to help change your relationship with sleep, to sleep meditations that guide you to release tension throughout your body, soothe your mind, and drift into dreamland. Or if you're more into music, Calm Music offers sleep tracks designed to help you fall asleep and relax. Just 5 minutes of Calm can change your whole day. No wonder it was named Apple's 2017 App of the Year. Interested in trying? For a limited time, Court Junkie listeners can get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/junkie. It includes unlimited access to all of Calm's amazing content and premium programs. Get started today at calm.com/junkie. That's calm.com/junkie. One of my very favorite documentaries on Netflix is The Staircase, and I recently made my husband watch it with me as I shamelessly watched it for the second time, and he loved it too. So let's say you just finished watching a gripping Netflix documentary series or film, and you're at a total loss for what to do next. Well, good news. Now there's You Can't Make This Up, a new podcast from Netflix that takes a look behind the scenes of the shows everyone's talking about, including Making a Murderer, the story of DNA exoneree Stephen Avery, who, in the midst of exposing corruption in local law enforcement, becomes the prime suspect in a grisly crime. Wild, Wild Country, the story of a sex cult that took over a small Oregon town in the 80s. And Evil Genius, the crazy account of a pizza delivery man who robbed a bank with a bomb around his neck. In each episode, podcasters, journalists, and comedians chat with show creators to get an exclusive look inside their process, explore stories they left out, and find answers to your burning questions. They'll also talk about twice convicted and acquitted Amanda Knox and the Academy Award-winning film Icarus. Tell me this podcast isn't perfect for those of you who love watching this stuff on Netflix. You Can't Make This Up, available on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or your preferred podcast destination. Go listen, subscribe, and review now. The defense wasted no time in calling Cynthia to the stand, who testified that she met Todd in 1999 through a mutual friend. Within 6 months of their meeting, she and Todd were married. She said she loved him and that they had a lot of fun together. They just clicked, she said. She said Todd started to get sick on February 8, 2002, after he went on a trip with his fellow Marines to El Centro. But she said she thought he was getting better until he collapsed. She recalled when she last saw her husband as he was being taken away in a gurney. She said she told him that she loved him, hugged him, and then took his wedding ring off and put it on her thumb. She admitted to getting breast implants about 2 months later, but said Todd knew that she was going to do it. It was never a secret, and that he was in favor of it. She read aloud a card Todd had given her on Valentine's Day, just days before his death. It read, "Happy Valentine's Day, Princess. My life is so happy with you in it. I couldn't imagine things any other way. Maybe for next Valentine's, you can get yourself a set of boobies. Thanks, you. Or thanks for making me better last week. Love you forever, Todd. After Todd died, she said she couldn't sleep and couldn't eat, and so she went to a doctor. She said she just really couldn't function. On April 18th, she went to the plastic surgeon to get her breast augmentation surgery. Later that night, she said she met another Marine, someone who she said she's engaged to today. On cross-examination, prosecutor Laura Gunn brought out an email Cynthia had written to her new fiancé. The email read, quote, "I couldn't see 5 years into the future with Todd. Baby, I see 50 with you." When asked what she meant by that, she admitted that she never saw herself being old with Todd. She was also questioned about how she was able to give Todd CPR while also being on the phone with 911. Cynthia said she didn't really remember much from that night. Janet Lippert, Cynthia's mom, was called to the stand to testify about Cynthia and Todd's relationship. She said Cynthia was extremely proud of Todd and that she enjoyed being the wife of a Marine. She said Todd was a wonderful son-in-law and a great stepfather to Cynthia's kids, and he treated them as his own. She then testified that Cynthia was hysterical when Todd died. She said when she arrived at Todd and Cynthia's house sometime after his death, Cynthia was curled up in the fetal position in her bed, clinging on to one of Todd's shirts and sobbing uncontrollably. Janet said she took her to the local clinic where she was treated for insomnia and acute grief. Janet said Cynthia kept saying, "I just don't know what I'm going to do," over and over again. She said an officer came over to the house to explain the benefits that she would be receiving and said Cynthia had no idea what they were prior to that. She said Cynthia also got a tattoo dedicated to Todd with his name, birth date, death date, and the Marine Corps motto. A friend of Cynthia's testified that she and Cynthia would take their kids to church together and that they talked every day. She told the court that she was actually jealous of the relationship Cynthia and Todd had. She said when Todd was deployed, Cynthia would get really sad because she missed him. The defense also called their own arsenic experts to the stand. The first was Dr. Alphonse Poklas, who had initially been contacted by the prosecution, but was now testifying on behalf of the defense. Dr. Poklas testified that he didn't believe that Todd was poisoned with arsenic for a number of reasons. One, the fact that Todd had been getting better. After going to the doctor in the days before his death, he continued to go to work and even went to the amusement park with his family the weekend he died. Dr. Poklas said that with levels over 1,000 times normal in the liver, Todd would have been sick and at a hospital, suffering from severe progressive symptoms and organ failure. Death would come quick, he said, and it would be a violent and painful death. Two, when Todd went to the clinic a few days before he died, blood tests were done, and everything came back normal. If Todd had had a massive dose of arsenic in his system, his white blood cells would have been abnormal, and his blood pressure would have been low. Instead, it was slightly elevated. And three, with such high levels of arsenic in the liver and kidneys, you would expect to find elevated levels of arsenic everywhere. Arsenic would spread throughout his body, and organs would be damaged. Dr. Poklas said the acute arsenic theory makes absolutely no sense, and he was concerned whether Todd had really been poisoned and what in the world was going on and who took this test, he said. The defense had another expert who agreed with Dr. Poklas. Dr. Laura LeBay, a forensic toxicologist at National Medical Services Lab, looked at the lab work done by the AFIP. She said she looked at Todd's blood, urine, gastric fluid, and bile, along with various tissue samples. She told the court that the plastic container holding Todd's bile was cracked, and some of the sample had leaked out. Dr. LeBay testified that although she agreed that there were significantly elevated levels of arsenic in Todd's liver and kidney tissues, she said she didn't agree that it was due to acute arsenic poisoning. She, too, said that Todd's other levels should have been elevated and that his organs would have been damaged. Dr. LeBay also took issue with the way the AFIP tested the tissue samples. She said their methods were unacceptable. Dr. LeBay also said she didn't agree with the prosecution that Todd could have been given one large dose of arsenic around February 8th. She said it wasn't conceivable that he would have been able to walk around for 10 days without being severely ill. Dr. LeBay's supervisor, Ella Bukowska, agreed with Dr. LeBay and also testified that she found disturbing problems with what the AFIP did. She said there were calculation errors, data that lacked labels, and no reference to a chain of custody. She pointed out that there wasn't even a summary sheet. The defense rested, but then they suffered a major blow when the judge ruled that the prosecution could now introduce evidence of Cynthia's behavior after Todd's death. The prosecution had argued that because Cynthia's attorney, Robert Udell, had questioned Cynthia's mom about how she had reacted to the loss of her husband, that then opened the door to the prosecution witnesses to rebut that, and Judge Detta agreed. So in the prosecution's rebuttal, they introduced even more damaging evidence about Cynthia's behavior. They called two of Cynthia's former co-workers to the stand, who testified that just months after Todd died, Cynthia went to Tijuana with them and participated in a wet t-shirt and thong contest. One of the co-workers said that the day after Todd died, Cynthia came into work and casually told them what happened. She said she wasn't acting as though it was serious. But the other co-worker told Cynthia's attorney on cross that she did think Cynthia was acting like a grieving widow, that she was just showing it in her own way. Three Marines then took the stand and testified that they had sex with Cynthia in the weeks following Todd's death, one of them telling the court that he and his wife had had a threesome with her. That same Marine recounted how he had seen Cynthia's now fiancé driving Todd's car around, which made him upset. In her closing arguments, Prosecutor Gunn told the jury that Cynthia connived everyone at first into thinking that she was a grieving widow, but that her words and actions after Todd died showed otherwise. She said Cynthia had an aha moment shortly after Todd's trust fund ran out in January, and so she decided to poison him for the insurance money. She recapped Cynthia's behavior afterwards, noting the breast implants, the sex with four different Marines, the loud parties, and the wild trip to Tijuana. "This is not somebody who's grieving," she said. "This is somebody who's celebrating." "What else shows her true colors?" she asked. "Four sexual partners just in the first 2 months after Todd died." She also said that nobody else could have poisoned Todd and surmised that Cynthia possibly got the arsenic from ant traps and then gave a large dose to her husband. But when Udell gave his closing arguments, he said there was no evidence that Cynthia poisoned Todd and no evidence that he had even died from acute arsenic poisoning, that the military lab that conducted the results was questionable. Instead, he said the initial findings were correct, that Todd had died of a heart attack. He said Cynthia may have wanted more than she could afford on their monthly income, but that doesn't mean she killed him. The jury of 7 women and 5 men took about 12 hours to reach their verdict. Guilty. After the verdict was read and Cynthia was taken back into custody, Laura Gunn gave a press conference outside the courthouse, saying that she was so glad that Todd's family has justice, finally, for the death of their son. She said she had spoken with the jurors after the verdict and that they had accepted early on that Todd had died of arsenic poisoning, that once you do that, there's nobody else who could have done it. In a jailhouse interview, Cynthia said she was very shocked, that she was shocked that she was arrested, shocked that she had spent 15 months in jail already, and shocked at the verdict. And this is the point where Alan Bloom, that renowned criminal defense attorney from San Diego, signed on to the case.
There was a lot of publicity about the case because of the sensational aspects of it, because it was a young woman and a young Marine and a kind of mysterious death. And then the sexual aspects, which the district attorney was attempting to gain a lot of mileage on the case. So it was a prominent case. Before I came on to the case on the news here in San Diego. And I didn't know the attorney who was representing Cindy. He was an attorney primarily from Florida. So I didn't have much contact with him personally, but it was kind of in the headlines. And after her conviction and after the controversy came out, the controversy being that there was so little evidence to convict her, yet she was convicted, almost a scarlet letter kind of conviction, because of her post-death behavior. She reacted to his death in a way that others wouldn't have reacted or didn't think that she should have reacted. She had sex with a friend of his. She had she went down to Tijuana and partied, and she had a breast implant. And because the district attorney made such a point of that, as opposed to real facts of the case, it got a lot of publicity. And when she got convicted, my girlfriend heard about the case, and she turned to me and said, "You should do something about that." And almost ironically, the next couple of days later, Cindy's cousin, Todd, gave me a call and asked if I would come on to the case and talk to him and talk to her about it. And so I did, and so I did.
Alan thought the prosecution's case had some major holes in it.
They couldn't find a single thing that linked Cindy to the possession of arsenic. Well, let me take that back. They found one thing, and I'll address it in 1 second. And they went after every different thing that they could find. They looked for everything. They even sent their investigator to the city of London in order to talk to a particular military person who had been transferred from San Diego to London. And their investigators, a team of them, went over to London to talk to this person because this person had knowledge that Cindy, or at least they thought, that Cindy had seen a particular TV show, a drama on TV, where somebody had been killed with arsenic. And so they said, "Well, we don't have anything to show that she has any contact with arsenic, but she saw a TV show, and therefore she's probably guilty." I mean, they were just going after every possible little straw that they could find. They tested, of course, they went after her computer. They tested, they looked at all of her phones. They looked at everything and found nothing except one thing. What they found in her house was a particular company's ant and roach bait little box. She had some ants in her house, and so she had this ant repellent. And they said it has arsenic in it. Well, they never showed her purchasing this amount. And when we get finally, when the district attorney raised this issue, it was one of the points that we had discussed about how the first lawyer didn't do the job he should have done. We determined that in order to take this particular product and take a look at how much it contained, how much arsenic it contained, and compared it to the amount of arsenic that was in Todd's two tissues of liver and kidney, the district attorney's argument that she could have killed him by feeding him this ant roach, this ant bait poison, we determined that she would have had to have fed him 12 pounds of this material, not over the course of like a day or two or something, but in a single day. I mean, a hamburger is a quarter pounder. So when you go to McDonald's, you get a quarter pound of meat. So they wanted to say that she had to have 64, even the volume itself is absurd, but she would have had to have 64 sizes of quarter pounders. Let me give you 64. Nobody can even eat four, let alone 64 quarter pounders. And he would have had to eat 64 of them in order to get 12 pounds of this stuff. And it wasn't burgers. He would have had to eat ant bait. The absurdity of that, you would have thought, would have stopped the district attorney from emphasizing the only thing that they could was that she had not suffered grief as she should have.
So Alan decided to take on Cynthia's case. And one of the first things he did was rather unusual. He decided to file a motion for a new trial based on ineffective assistance of counsel. Remember that Cynthia's trial attorney, Robert Udell, had opened the door for the testimony about Cynthia's sex life and trip to Tijuana to come in, and Alan saw that as a big mistake. Not only that, but Alan questioned whether Todd had been poisoned at all.
when I started all over, I wasn't sure exactly what we were going to find. But as it turned out, what we found was primarily that the trial lawyer who had represented Cindy was trying hard, doing his best, but had overlooked a lot of different things, and particularly had overlooked the fact that there was no attack to the fact that her husband had not died from an arsenic poison overdose at all. In effect, the trial lawyer was saying, okay, conceding that he had died from this poison, but said it wasn't Cindy, and not sure exactly how it was, or maybe he contracted it by being someplace else, like in a field on a in East County, far away from here, which was like an open field where there were contaminants and a lot of agricultural things and pesticides and stuff. And so whatever happened, he must have gotten it from there. But he didn't start at the beginning to show that her husband had not died from poison at all.
In what perhaps was a surprise to everyone, Judge Detta delayed Cynthia's sentencing and also, in an unusual move, decided to hold a special hearing where Robert Udell could testify. At the hearing, Udell admitted that he had made several errors in representing Cynthia and that he felt terrible about the verdict. But prosecutor Laura Gunn argued that that wasn't enough to overrule the jury. She said Udell did his job within the bar and that Cynthia was convicted because Todd's tissue was filled with arsenic and she had a giant financial motive and wanted out. But Judge Detta disagreed, saying, quote, "Mr. Udell has an approach to this case that was focused. In being so focused, he missed many areas that would have been fruitful for his defense. And in missing those areas, I believe that he has been ineffective. Based on that, I'm going to order that Ms. Summer be allowed to have a new trial." So on November 30th, 2007, instead of being sentenced, Cynthia was granted a new trial. Instead of just picking up where her last attorney had left off, Alan wanted to start from the very beginning and get access to all the evidence in the case in order to prep for Cynthia's new trial.
When I took over the case, there were, I'm going to estimate like 30,000 pages of documents. There were thousands and thousands of pages of documents, and it took a while to get into that.
As he was going through the many documents, he discovered some rather interesting emails between the prosecution and their own arsenic experts. One of the most suspicious aspects of the alleged arsenic poisoning was that of the 12 tissue samples tested, only two of them, the ones from the kidneys and liver, came back as positive. The other 10 were negative. And as the defense experts in the case said, that's not the way arsenic poisoning typically works. You would typically find arsenic everywhere, in all the tissues. Well, in the emails Alan discovered, it appeared that the experts from AFIP, the ones who conducted the test, were confused by this as well.
We found the emails and we discovered and asked for more emails between the people from the American, Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, AFIP, who did the evaluation, who ultimately were sued and their practices were enormously contested. The AFIP sent a lot of emails between themselves that weren't revealed entirely to the defense lawyer. Some were, but some weren't, that showed that they themselves had tremendous suspicions about their findings. They had never seen anything like it. So we discovered all these emails, which raised a whole lot of question marks. And all these emails are flying back and nobody can explain it. Basically, the doctors were saying, I've never seen anything like this. We don't understand it. And then the prosecutor, the DA, Laura Gunn, was basically sort of sending the emails, sort of cajoling them, saying, well, there could be an explanation here or there could be an explanation there, right? And the prosecutor agents, the police agents, which were through the Naval Crime Institute, NCIS, they were doing the same thing, kind of cajoling their own two doctors to say, well, it could be explained. Maybe you've never seen it for this reason or that reason.
And then he found something else in the files. Mention of another set of backup tissues that hadn't yet been tested. Alan contacted the DA's office to see where those backup tissues were.
I made multiple requests to the district attorney to find out where they were. And there was this tremendous sandbagging by the district attorney, Laura Gunn. She tried to obfuscate and push us to different areas and say she'll get back to us on it and so forth, and never did. But we didn't give up on it, and we said we need to have these reviewed. Finally, when we sent an investigator, and we finally found the source of them and found it that we were not going to get a response from the district attorney's office, I went to the San Diego Naval Hospital. We have a hospital called Balboa Hospital, which is the Naval Hospital, and that's where the autopsy was done on Todd. And we went to the pathology department to find the tissues, and my investigator contacted the department where they should have been. And in fact, they looked at naval records. We showed them the records we had, and they said, yes, we have those. We have another set of tissues. And what was ironic about it, or actually it's more than ironic, it's what was really nefarious and underhanded about it, was that when he discovered these tissues, it went to a particular refrigerator. And sitting on top of the refrigerator, preserved as they should have been, in a manner that was appropriate for preserving them, was a box where these other tissues are. And on the box was labeled, "Do not destroy, but do not produce." Signed, Laura Gunn, Deputy District Attorney. So Laura Gunn knew of these tissues and attempted to hide them and not present them to the defense.
Alan contacted the DA's office to demand that the tissues be turned over to them so they could have them tested. And he was about to go through the court to get them when the DA's office decided to handle it themselves.
And it was at that point when I demanded that they be produced for us, and that, and her response was, before I filed a motion with the court to have them tested and released to the defense. I didn't trust them at all for the testing of it. I didn't trust the AFIP because I felt their work was sloppy. They had something to protect and that they had contaminated the first set. I didn't trust the district attorney's people because she had been sitting on this information for several years. All this time that Cindy is sitting in jail and missing her kid's graduation and missing this and missing that. And Gunn is arguing in front of the jury how strong this evidence is. She knows that it's weak. And she knows also there's another way of finding out and solving the issue because there's another set of tissues. So I didn't trust the district attorney to do the right thing. And I filed the order for the court to order the release of these materials so that a defense investigator, a defense expert, a defense team could take a look at the tissues before the judge issued signed the order. Instead of just responding to the order, Gunn on her own took the tissues away and sent them over to a laboratory. It turns out she went to a laboratory which was highly respected, probably one I would have used as well. I think they were Canadian, or they have a Canadian connection as well as the U.S., but they're very, very well known. They have been described as being the gold standard of laboratories because they're so incredibly solid and reliable. She ended up going to a good place, I think inadvertently or for whatever reason, she ended up going to a good place. And they did a full test on these tissues, including the very same tissues that the liver and kidney that had been offending, that had been so contaminated, had showed fatal amounts. And of course, they showed nothing. All the other tissues tested with nothing, and liver and kidney tested with nothing.
All the tissues tested negative for any kind of arsenic poisoning, meaning Todd was never poisoned. So you're probably wondering what happened next.
Without any notification, on an afternoon, it was about 4:30 in the afternoon, and it was a Tuesday. I think it was a Tuesday because I was playing golf. And I got the call saying, "Do I have any objection to the district attorney dismissing this case. And the court wanted to know if I was going to make an appearance that afternoon, because it had been scheduled that afternoon without my knowledge. And I said, no, most definitely I want to be there. And appearing in my UCLA golfing shirt, I went to court. And because ironically, at the time I got the call, I was on it's going to sound silly, but I was on the 17th tee box at Balboa Park, and immediately to my right on this elevated golfing hole was Balboa Hospital. And from where you're standing there at this golf course, I'm looking at Balboa Hospital, and as I'm talking to the judge's clerk, I'm looking at the courthouse, because I can see both from right there. And I said, yes, I most definitely want to be there. And we went to court that afternoon. And even though there was a tremendous effort, I think there was even a last minute effort to keep it quiet. And that's why it was done so quickly. I don't know that for sure. But all I know is it's very unusual to come to me and say, okay, that's already been filed. Do I want to appear? The district attorney would have done it on its own. She would have done it on her own without me being there. The judge properly said, no, this is a matter which everybody has a right to appear at. And so we're going to give the defense the opportunity to be present. So even that was done in a very unusual and shifty way.
Later that afternoon, the case was dismissed and Cynthia was free.
And that evening, I went with my girlfriend to the San Diego County Jail Women's Facility, which is in the eastern part of our county. And there was Cindy ready to get out. She had been told.
The San Diego District Attorney, Bonnie Dumanis, released a statement after the charges were dropped. Quote, "As District Attorney for San Diego County, the buck stops with me. In the high-profile prosecution of Cynthia Summer for murder, our office made the right choices for the right reasons at every step in the process. But last week, we were all reminded that the criminal justice system is not perfect, and I understand how recent developments in the case raise several questions. Were tissue samples tainted? Could new testing have been done sooner? How could a convicted murderer suddenly walk out of jail a free woman? I wish things had gone differently, but there are checks and balances in the criminal justice system designed to protect both crime victims and criminal defendants along the way. As prosecutors, we followed our ethical duty in this case, and while Ms. Summer came close to spending the rest of her life in prison, the system eventually worked." She went on to explain why they had filed murder charges in the first place. The arsenic levels that had tested positive. There was no other medical explanation for Todd's death. Cynthia's apparent financial motive, along with her odd behavior. She said they sent the extra set of tissues to be tested out of fairness to the defendant and because it's their job to pursue the truth. She said the results shocked them. Quote, "Within hours of hearing confirmation of this new information, we dismissed murder charges against Cynthia Summer. We did not want her to spend even one more day in jail, and we took action as soon as the judge in the case could review our motion in court. As prosecutors, when we receive information like this, it's our duty to act, and act quickly." So why did the arsenic levels show up in the first testing? Alan has a theory.
When they did the testing, when AFIP did the testing and had these 12 samples, somehow the samples that they tested for liver and kidney somehow got contaminated. And for example, formaldehyde and other types of agents that they use on the laboratory workbench, which shouldn't be introduced from one case to another, probably affected these two tissues, meaning some other agent, some other solution from some other case that was part of the lab bench inadvertently found its way onto the tissues for the liver and kidney. And that's why they were so spiked high with the arsenic and the others were clean.
Cynthia filed a lawsuit in September 2009, alleging that prosecutors in the NCIS falsified evidence, improperly arrested her, withheld key evidence, and failed to disclose relevant facts that could have helped her case. But her lawsuit was thrown out 4 years later, after a federal judge ruled that she couldn't prove any of her allegations. And since Cynthia was never imprisoned, she wasn't eligible to be compensated in another way either.
The government never gave her any money for a wrongful conviction because we stopped the conviction because the appeal took place in between the jury verdict of guilty and the sentencing. Had she been sentenced and then we got it overturned, she would have received, I think it's $100 a day, not much, but at least it's something, $100 a day for every day that she was in jail of the almost 3 years she was in custody, away from her family, away from her kids, having lost custody and control of her kids, been away when they were having their graduation and all those special things. She would have at least received some small compensation for that had she been convicted, meaning been sentenced.
The San Diego District Attorney's Office released another statement after Cynthia's lawsuit was dismissed. Quote, over the last 17 months, Ms. Summers' new attorney has repeatedly accused the trial prosecutor, Deputy District Attorney Laura Gunn, of gross prosecutorial misconduct. Today, the court made a finding that counsel for Ms. Summers has presented no evidence to support those accusations. As District Attorney, I have personally reviewed every aspect of the handling of this case in great detail. The accusations made by Ms. Summers' counsel are untrue. At all times during the prosecution of Ms. Summers, DDA Gunn acted in a professional, ethical, and legally appropriate manner. There will be no further comment about this case at this time.
Had it been a situation that they had never really seen that second set of tissues and had inadvertently found it and then retested it, then you would be in a position to say, okay, we were vigorous in our initial prosecution. We based it upon a lot of emotion, but we really thought she was guilty. And we had, and the evidence was there, even though the evidence was suspicious, the evidence was there showing that she had these deadly amounts of arsenic in these two tissues. And she was the person who had most access to her husband. And therefore, we gave it to the jury to decide. They came back guilty. That's all part of being an effective prosecutor and being an aggressive prosecutor and doing your job. But when you know there's another set of tissues and you hide that information, you're not doing your job at that point.
It's interesting to note that when the district attorney dropped the charges, she did so without prejudice, meaning she was leaving the door open so Cynthia could potentially be retried one day. I asked Alan about that.
And do you think that there's a chance that she could ever be retried?
Well, anything's theoretically possible. I mean, there's a chance that that you could be called by NASA tomorrow because they need a new astronaut to go to Mars in a new expedition. I guess you could say there's a possibility, and then they could ask me to, somebody who has never flown a plane in their life, to fly the jet, to fly the aircraft to get us up there. I mean, these things are theoretically possible. So if you ask a question of that, the way you just asked me, could it ever happen? The answer is yes, anything can happen. But will she ever be tried? No, of course not.
Cynthia has since asked a judge to dismiss her case with prejudice, ensuring that she would never again be charged for Todd's murder. But the judge denied her request, although he said he couldn't imagine this case ever being retried. And that's all for this episode. Let me know what you think about this case. Was Cynthia treated fairly by our justice system? Did the prosecution do the right thing? Or do you agree with Cynthia's attorney? And if you do think Cynthia was wrongfully tried, should there be any compensation for that? Let me know by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, sending me an email at podcast@courtjunkie.com, or by joining my Facebook discussion group at courtjunkie.com/Facebook. A special thank you goes out to Calm, one of my sponsors of today's episode. Calm, the number one app for sleep, meditation, and relaxation, gives you the tools you need to live a happier, healthier, and more mindful life. Just 5 minutes of Calm can change your whole day. Interested in trying? For a limited time, Court Junkie listeners can get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/junkie. It includes unlimited access to all of Calm's amazing content and premium programs like Calm Music, Sleep Meditations, and Sleep Stories, designed to soothe your mind into dreamland. Get started today at calm.com/junkie. That's calm.com/junkie. I also want to give a shout out to my friends over at the Minds of Madness podcast. If you haven't heard of them yet, definitely check them out. Here's a trailer for their pod.
911, what's your emergency?
Every 60 seconds, a person is murdered somewhere in the world.
There was a shootout at my house. I can't believe it.
What causes ordinary people to do unthinkable things?
He stabbed me in my neck. And he says, look how easily I could kill you.
The Minds of Madness is a true crime podcast that examines the most disturbing criminal minds. We shed a light on the devastating impact these violent crimes have on the victims and their families.
When you get calls in the night, you know they're not good or they're wrong numbers.
You'll hear about the incredible strength of the survivors and what they did to fight back.
I was studying his face because I was thinking, if I get out of this, I'm going to get you someday.
Subscribe to the Minds of Madness podcast today on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Play.
As always, if you don't want to hear the ads like the ones you heard in this episode, you can donate as little as a dollar a month by going to courtjunkie.com/support. That will redirect you to my Patreon page where you can donate a dollar a month to this podcast and get the episodes early and ad-free. That's courtjunkie.com/support. Once again, thanks everyone for listening. Until next time.